The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. I am Bob Branco. Good to be with all of you today. This is episode 469, dated Friday, June 19th, 2026. Happy Juneteenth, everybody. Before we continue, allow me to introduce my good friend, colleague, and co-host for this program, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on?
I am currently at a campground in southwest Oregon. It's cloudy and sort of chilly, and I am missing my jalapeno brat as we speak, but I'm happy to do this because I'm happy to be part of the show. And if you hear some ambient noise out the window, it's because I have grandkids here, and they're having a great time, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, when we're finished, you can have that appetizer or whatever you call it, broth, whatever you want to call it.
That's right.
Anyway, before we continue, I just want to report the weather here. It's a nice day today, 70s, close to 80. We're going to have a nice, dry, seasonable weekend here in southern Massachusetts. Allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. I also want to thank our media sources for airing us when they do. Thanks so much. Also, Peter from Canada. Thank you for posting our programs on your chat boards. We appreciate that. And finally, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. Thank you very much for archiving our programs on my website. In order for you to find them, go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcast. Click on them. And you will find all of our archives, or most of them anyway, from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to Trish, who's our host for today's program, along with Brad, who is our streamer. And because we are being streamed live, let me give out my email address for those people who would like to write us, tell us what they think about our program. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. bobbranco93@gmail.com. We have with us once again John Gizzi, a Newsmax columnist. He's back on our program to talk about whatever's on your mind and his mind.
Mm-hmm.
John, welcome back to our program. It's great having you.
Always glad to be here, Bob, and I look forward to the discussion as usual.
Well, I think one of the things I would like to start out by asking you, and this is a hypothetical question, when are we going to have peace in the world again?
Well, I could answer that I don't do hypotheticals, but because one never knows what will happen. People ask me who'll be elected president in 2028. I have no idea.
Well, then it's not hypothetical. It's a good question. Let's put it that way. When are we going to have peace in this world?
Well, let me point out, right now, looking at the genesis of the Memorandum of Understanding, it appears as though, for a time at least, there will be peace in the Middle East. Now, of course, peace in the Middle East sounds almost like an oxymoron, and it certainly changes over different circumstances in that part of the world, different countries being upset. I would point out that the modern history of other countries is anything but refulgent. And I would just look at Latin America, where Colombia, where I recently was, is having their runoff election for president. And it will be a very dramatic change from the recent past. Peru just had a close election, one of the closest elections in the history of electing one's leaders. The country moved on without violence or anything beyond peaceful protest. I would say that Kyiv and Ukraine is, and Moscow in Russia are turbulent places these days. But at the same time, one gets the impression that this may be coming to a conclusion. The Russian economy is near toppling at this point. President Putin is having to rely on arm twisting of oligarchs and the raising of fees and certain taxes in order to keep the government run while much of the economy is devoted to a war that they're clearly not winning after more than 4 years. I suspect we may see peace in that part of the world sooner rather than later.
We also have Lebanon, Hezbollah, Israel. That's still boiling.
Hezbollah and Israel, for now at least, have agreed to halt their respective bombing of one another. How long that lasts, I don't know. But I can say that as of today, their guns are silent on both sides.
Good. John, let's go back to Russia and Kyiv first, Ukraine for a second. It feels to me that the whole issue of how you fight wars are changing as we speak. And thinking about, is the whole drone thing. I mean, the Russians, destroyed one of Ukraine's, shrines, and the Ukrainians responded by hitting Moscow. Who would have thought this would be possible? And you sort of indicated that, that you hope that peace would happen, and it might very well, but it sure doesn't seem that way now. They seem to be escalating both sides.
I would tend to differ with you, Peter, on that, with respect. And here's why. Who would have thought that Ukraine, which 4 years ago was turning to the free world, to the Western Europe, to the United States and other places for help from anywhere, and now 60% of the drones that are used in the Ukraine-Russo war are manufactured in, guess where? Ukraine.
Ukraine, yep.
And they are also working closely with Israel on drones as well. The fact is that here is a small country, not even a member of NATO or the European Union, that is developing on its own as a powerhouse in Europe. As the old saying goes, who would have thought?
Yeah.
That's why when Russia did hit a shrine, they were able to hit back right away. Yes, the nature of warfare is changing in the sense that a country that throws itself into building a defensive and offensive mechanism can succeed and do so quickly. I do believe.
And inexpensively, right? Mm-hmm. These drones don't cost a lot of money, as I understand it.
No, they don't.
They're relatively cheap.
Yeah. I recently had dinner with a Ukrainian businessman, someone who, specializes in wind energy, and he's had some of his plants and some of his windmills destroyed by Russian drones. He does not like President Zelensky at all, but like a lot of Ukrainians, he said that's the man in charge right now, and he is behind him, but only until he finally gets the war ended. And this same gentleman is very optimistic about the ending of the war.
And I hope he's right. I just, it feels so different. You know, I never would expect anybody attacking Moscow. Who would have thought that would have happened even a year ago?
Yeah.
That it was impossible.
Factor,
and now you have.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There's one other factor, a postscript I would add to it. Vladimir Putin, and this has been reported in the Financial Times, the New York Times and other sources, is increasingly reclusive. He operates during the day. In a bunker, he sleeps in different residences by night. This is someone who clearly does not sleep well and is uncertain about the future of the war that he started. Also remember, he barely survived a coup d'etat earlier in the war, which almost would have led to Russia suing for peace with Ukraine. It did not happen, of course, and the coup plotter eventually died in a mysterious plane crash. But that said, there are those in Russia who are not enamored with the leadership of their president.
I just thought, you're right. And there seems to be possibilities for peace, but right now, you know, there seems to be, and usually often what happens is there's an uptick in violence before the actual peace happens. So let's hope that that's the case here too. I want to sort of pivot to what's going on in Iran, because I think the Iranians are doing the same thing to us that the Ukrainians are doing to the Russians with those drones. You know, it's easy for them to attack ships and our bases, and are easier with those drones. And it's making our lives a lot more difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, us is the U.S. Military more complicated.
All right. There's a couple of things to remember with this. Number one, with the memorandum that's come out, the memorandum of understanding, the hold on ships and others by Lloyd's of London and other outsiders has been loosened at this point. You're going to have a lot more going through the Straits of Hormuz. As for the attacks on the U.S., okay, that is an unfortunate situation, but this is what happens in war. 13 Americans were killed. I would just point out that in training exercises, an average of 200 American servicemen are killed each year. Any death is sad in war, but I would just say, look at the overall picture of it. It is true that Iran has learned from Ukraine. In fact, there are magazine articles in Iran in which they write about how Ukraine was able to develop drone technology enough and hold back a much larger oppressor. The parallels are almost eerie between Ukraine fighting Russia and Iran fighting the United States. All things considered, let's see how this agreement works out. And more than that, remember, and this was not reported to a great extent, the protests against the regime right up till 2 days before February 28th and the initial bombing in Operation Epic Fury, were growing. No matter how much the government tried to put them down, they kept coming to the streets, tearing down statues. They even renamed a street in front of a government building, Donald Trump Avenue. And those protests continued after the bombing. We don't know about it because the internet was shut down by the regime along with its stock exchange. Not exactly a good move when it comes to the economy. But I can assure you, people in the diaspora community said the protests continued, the downing of statues of the Ayatollahs occurred, and will still occur right now.
We will see. The one thing that we've talked about on this show before has to do with Iran and their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to know what it looks like. You know, it's, what do they have? And to be perfectly blunt, I don't see how we can prevent them from getting the nuclear weapon. I just don't see it. I mean, if you look at Ukraine again, one of the reasons they got into the trouble they got into is because they gave up their nuclear, weapons.
Yes.
In return for protection. And we know what happened. So mm-hmm. I hope that we can find a way of, you know, nobody wants Iran to have nuclear weapons.
No.
I don't know how we make that happen.
No. And again, I still say it's what will happen. Barack Obama could not do it with the agreement that he had. We will see about the current agreement. I'm not optimistic at all, Peter, because the Iranians don't argue any agreement, but I'm also a believer that as long as protests continued and as long as there's opposition, that we may one day be dealing with a new government and that the point about nuclear weapons will be moot because this is a government that will cooperate with the Western world. One other thing on that is that I've been in discussions and I've been meetings with the diaspora community, and one of the things that was made clear is that the people who protest in the street, rather than the exiles around the world, will comprise a new government when and if that happens. As Gideon Saar, the Israeli foreign minister, once told me in response to a question about this, the regime change will not come from the skies, but from the streets. And I talked recently to the coach of the Iranian women's football team. That's right. She flies back just to coach the girls, and as she puts it. And she tells me if they broke open a prison in Tehran, they'd have a whole cabinet there.
It is my understanding, John, that if the agreement works out between the United States and Iran, there is going to be a 60-day period for other things to be ironed out. Could you explain the details about what's going to happen in those 60 days, or what could happen in those 60 days if everything proceeds as it was meant to?
Yes, exactly.
Let me frame the question a little bit differently, because I think it's important.
Sure.
I think Bob's question is a good one, but what I'm curious is, what is the best that could happen if everything goes smoothly in the next 60 days? What that might look like? We don't have to talk about what the worst look like, because we know what that already is, I think, for the most part. If things went reasonably well, what would happen that would be good?
Well, for starters, there would be no drones in the air. Tehran would not be hit with drones, nor would Lebanon be hit with drones, nor would Israel been hit. In other words, a ceasefire would be just what it is, a ceasefire. I would also add that what will happen in the coming days is that there will be the Straits of Hormuz opening up. The mines, if there were any laid, and there's some skepticism about that, will be assuredly removed, and commerce will continue in that part of the world. The other things to think about are that Iran will cease trying to work and spread terror throughout the world. And quite frankly, remember, the regime is on life support, because this time it was not able to call on any allies. Syria's government, formerly very convivial with Tehran, was overthrown, and the strongman Bashar Assad fled to Russia. The Houthis, no longer a factor there. The only person they could count on, of course, Hezbollah, the only group I should say they could count on, Hezbollah, whom they give orders to, essentially, and then Russia and China, both of whom are a little busy these days with other things. Hence the precariousness of the regime, even after all those days of bombing.
Yeah, no, there is, you could argue both ways situation, because there are certainly some, we have our problems as far as this is concerned, not the least of which is, people in this country generally didn't like that we got in this war in the first place.
So the support
is not particularly strong here. And there's an election coming up in 2026. And, you know, with the gas price and everything else, we do have issues, on our side that are complicated. All we could do, I think, is to see what happens in the next 60 days.
Right. One thing. Gas prices are dropping right now. I agree
with you
totally. If they were what they were 3 weeks ago, it would be very, very dangerous for Republicans. I was having breakfast with someone in the energy business, and out the window we could see a gas station with the prices of gasoline. And this fellow said, If those are the prices on Labor Day, the Republicans are doomed. Well, they're not the prices today. And I took a look at the market a little while ago. It's doing fine.
Go ahead. I don't know what's going on.
I think the average gasoline price in this country right now is about $4.05.
Right.
$3.99 as of this morning.
I was in Michigan last week, and a Republican political consultant told me, if on the eve of the election, gas is $3.50 per gallon, Republicans will be fine. So they're getting close to that.
So I want to talk about one more foreign issue, which we talked about last time you were here, and that was Cuba.
Yes.
You know, we are still hosting a blockade there, as best as I understand it, and Cuba's not doing especially well government-wise. What are you hearing might happen next?
Well, I want to tell you something, and I'm going to use the opportunity, Peter, and the program to reveal this. A week ago, I got a call from a friend who wanted to come by and bring someone from the Cuban embassy here. Let me tell you that the Cuban embassy, its ambassador and staff, are very anxious to talk to American reporters who are not going to be dismissive of them and give them a cold shoulder. They get dismissed by people in Congress, by the State Department, Secretary Rubio being the first Secretary of State of Cuban heritage. And they know they're not exactly the most popular kids in town. The diplomat told me they were looking for members of Congress who would be friendly, who would at least listen to them and talk about some kind of an agreement. I do know they were trying to reach President Trump a few weeks ago, and it was suggested they call the Fanjul family, who are Cuban exiles, very prominent in the Florida business and social communities, and supporters of President Trump. The idea was that while they may not like the Cuban government, they wouldn't turn down a call from the Cuban ambassador, and this would start a back channel to the White House from Cuban Americans and the Cuban diplomats. And no, the family would not do it, and there was no connection. All these things together may not sound important. But what they demonstrate to me is that the Cuban government or its representatives in the United States are trying anything to be heard by the government and try to make some kind of an agreement.
Who knows what that agreement would look like? I know this is not your area of expertise, but what might an agreement look like?
An agreement with Cuba? Yeah. Again, that's something not going to speculate on. I think it might be that you would allow the present government to remain in power, but there would have to be free elections at one point, and you would have to open the prisons that are there, and all things based on human rights before any kind of trade or business could be resumed with Cuba.
I guess what I'm pondering is what's going on in Venezuela is we got the president out of the country. He's in jail waiting for a trial or whatever. And now we have this vice president who is playing ball with us, it seems to me. She's allowing us to dictate terms of how they go. Yet, I'm not hearing much about social justice or, you know, freeing prisoners or any of that kind of stuff. I wonder if something might happen in Cuba.
Well, in Venezuela, let me just add a postscript. They are opening up the prisons. Sure. They will probably have elections next year. I can tell you, and I learned this when I was in Colombia recently, Dulcy Rodriguez, the president, Nicolas Maduro's vice president, is not going anywhere. I'm sure you see Maria Machado, who should have been elected president last time until the Maduro government kept her off the ballot. She's been awarded the Nobel Prize. She insists she's the rightful occupant of the presidency.
Angel, leave.
What?
Sorry, go ahead. My grandkid is bothering me. Okay. He's left. Go ahead.
Right. I can tell you from the highest sources, Dulce Rodriguez is going nowhere. She'll remain as president the rest of the year and next year. Why? Venezuelan oil is coming into Texas at the ports there. And this is all that the administration cares about at this point.
Right.
Now,
right.
The prisons are being open. People are coming out. But there is no rush to make Maria Machado president. If she runs in a campaign again next year and is elected, that's another story.
It just isn't clear to me, and maybe I'm not being fair to President Trump, that restoring human rights and democracy is not his top priority in anything. You know, he wants business to, you know, go back to the way it was in the 1950s, to be sort of exaggerated a little bit. But I don't think human rights is a big deal for him.
Most people say he's a transactional person. In other words, you get rid of Maduro and you put him on trial, and in turn, Venezuela starts doing business with the United States, and something comes out of it.
Right. Well, we'll see. So I want to do a pivot before I throw it open for questions. When you and I talked a couple of weeks ago, we talked about what was going on in California with the Los Angeles and the sort of complex of all that. So you speculated that I can't remember the Republican's name in the city of Los Angeles might make the final cut. He ended up not doing that.
Spencer Pratt.
Give us a sense of – yeah, Pratt, thank you. He didn't quite make it. What is your sense of what went on and what might happen in the future? And also, you think that's what happened?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the ballots kept coming in, you know, how long after?
Hold on. I want to hear Mr. Gizzi's response.
Let me tell you, Peter, that Spencer Pratt was in second place initially, and then as ballots come in, he fell to third place. Now, someone sent me a copy of the Los Angeles Times from November of 1966, 60 years ago. And the headline is, Reagan elected governor by 1 million votes. This is Wednesday morning after the vote. So I am wondering, if the votes could be counted overnight 60 years ago, why does it take 2 weeks? Put another way, when I was an observer of the election in Colombia, I asked if they had absentee ballots or early voting, such as in the United States. I got a flat no from officials. No absentee voting, no early voting. You want to vote? You show up between 8 to 4 Sunday. That's when they have elections because people have the day off. You vote on a paper ballot. It is counted right there, and you can have observers from all the campaigns. They send in the results to an election center, and guess what? The polls closed at 4. I knew the results at 7 and went out and had a steak. I don't understand why it takes 3 hours to count and declare a winner in Colombia and 3 weeks in California.
Bombia.
I was going to say, we should have elections on the weekends, generally speaking, in this country. That's been talked about by some radio people.
Well, also former UN Ambassador Andrew Young was chairman of a committee to change the election date to Sunday.
Interesting.
Well, you know,
Well, that is sport here in the United States, and I agree with you on it.
Yes.
I just wanted to one quick response to John Gizzy. Part of the reason that the votes took so long to count California is they allow people to mail in their ballots the day of the election, and they give mail a week to arrive. And there is a reason why the votes took so long to count. You may not like that policy. That's a whole nother conversation. Mm-hmm. It seems to me it's a reasonable nation as to why it took so long to count those ballots.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't like the policy.
John?
You're right. And if 60 years ago they knew who was elected governor and by what margin the next morning, I don't see why it's an improvement to have people mailing in ballots and then taking a week or two or three to count them. I don't call that progress.
That makes no sense. It takes hours to resolve a federal election in this country. This is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the presidential 2020 and become or have a little or you know, it's available and see where
Peter, your signal is off, Peter. Right. I don't know what's happening with your signal. What I would like to do in the meantime is turn our program over to our participants. And before we do that, I want to say hi to two faithful listeners, Becky Frankie Berger and Pauline O'Hadi. Thank you very much for listening.
Go ahead, Mitch.
Mitch from Southern Cal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Go right ahead, Mitch. Hello.
Good afternoon. And it is clear, John is someone who leans conservative, that there is a very clear lack of agreement within the conservative community. A couple of conservative commentators with whom I listen fairly often have a totally different view of the potential agreement, the memorandum of understanding, and I tend to side with them.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has on the right has complained about and with some justification Obama's previous agreement with Iran. What we're seeing and hearing about this MOU, it really doesn't look like it's an improvement at all. You talk about the fragility of the Iranian government. The day after the war was begun, my wife and I were in a paratransit vehicle, and the driver was an Iranian exile, and he couldn't have been more excited about the possibility of the overthrow of the Ayatollah. The government there now is stronger, not weaker, than it was. The people had their chance to take control the first week. They weren't able to do it. The crackdown, the Revolutionary Guard, doubled their efforts. The people were totally kept from doing any serious damage. The government now. And now they're going to get billions of dollars in the money that we had kept from them. Things aren't going to get better. There is no nuclear agreement. Honestly, you know, Donald Trump's reputation as a negotiator it doesn't cut any ice with most of us. Because most of us, whether we supported the war or didn't, and I did, most of us are seeing a document that is not worth the paper it's written on. In 60 days from now, nothing will be accomplished other than, for better or worse, the folks who the few folks that are supporting this war in this country are going to be even more in the minority than we are now. Donald Trump has not done anything to polish his reputation as a negotiator, and it's really unfortunate because there was an opportunity for regime change there. There was an opportunity to make bloody well sure that the nuclear material that was there and still is there was removed, and that's just not going to happen. And I hope, Bob, that in 3 months or so you have John back, because
yes.
I want to hear John justifying how nothing did change, even though this was supposed to be a turnaround time. So those are my comments about the situation.
Thank you, Mitch. John, any response before we move on to our next participant?
Yes, and thank you, Mitch, for the question and for the details that you laid out here. A couple of points I would just say with great respect. Number one, when you talk about the $300 billion that are going to go in this fund for Iran, not a penny of this will be from taxpayers in any countries. These will be individual and voluntary donations, mostly from the Abraham Accord nations, the Emirates, for example, and Saudi Arabia. And when they put money in, it never comes as just a gift. It's going to be with some influence and some outreach to Iran that could finally complete the regime change. I'm sure those countries would like it that way. Now, as for the uprising that was there, something I covered very closely and talked to the diaspora community about. On February 28th, in my neighborhood in Washington, D.C., there was a long march going down the streets, and Iranians living in the United States had a sign, "Thank you, President Trump, for killing Khamenei." They said the protests were working, but admittedly, people told me, they just could not depose the regime. They were hopeful that the bombing would help the protesters do that. Gideon Rockman, writing in the Financial Times, pointed out that you can tell the staying power of an autocracy by their willingness to kill their own people. And of course, the reports from Tehran are that IRGC troops were going into hospitals and shooting people who were wounded from the protests right in their hospital beds. They also had people arrested who were protested, put on trial, and hanged all the while they were fighting in the war that began February 28th. Yes, it's a hard regime. I'm not sure it's stronger, though, because one sees a chain of command that gets down to younger people, less experienced people, very much the way Germany at the end of World War II was. So I'm not sure about the staying power of the regime at all. I hope that answers some of your questions.
Well, as I said, I hope you're back in 3 months, because we'll talk about this further. I wish I were as optimistic as you. Unfortunately, I'm not. Thanks a lot. Take care.
And Mitch, we'll do our best to make that happen.
Okay, very good.
As long as it's agreeable with Mr. Gizzy here.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Peter. You sound pretty good.
Can you all hear me?
And we do have another hand.
My system. Go ahead.
Peter, who do we have?
Peter, we can hear you. Kevin is next.
All right, Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Terrific.
Well, fine.
I didn't have the pleasure of hearing your introduction, but I really appreciate your informed comments and insights. I I think you touched on several important points. Let me just start with the at home here with the elections. You know, I'm 100% in support of the Save America Act, and California is a perfect example of why we need that. You know, in France, there's 66 million voters they have to count by the end of night. California has 39.5 million, and it's never. In fact, I have a friend, just moved from California. I'm in Idaho. But he just moved from California. He's from England. He's a legal. He is legal and a national citizen here, but or not a citizen, but a legal immigrant. And, but he went to get his driver's license and they automatically enrolled him as a Democrat to vote. And he had went back and had to argue with them to take him off. He said, look, I'm not eligible to vote. You know, I'm not a U.S. citizen yet. And, they argued they did not want to remove him from the voter rolls. And that's part of one, just part of the example of, but anyway, regarding Iran, I think you touched on this a little bit with Venezuela. I think there's some dramatic changes there. Clearly, I think they're a long, long time from acquiring a nuclear weapon there now. So I think that issue has been addressed. Was it a wise decision to go in there? Well, that is certainly, I think, debatable. And I think we were led somewhat down a primrose.
This has left the meeting alert.
Primrose path, with, by Israel intelligence, maybe, but the fact of the matter is,
5:42 p.m. Three notifications from Sam. Now, Belinda Collins, community hosts. Thanks, Julie.
And I agree with you. I think it's yet to be seen, because of that and other reasons, we still could see the stories, the chapters of the story have not been written yet. On what it's going to look like as far as an administration or the future, ruling, authorities there. And so, because of that, they are hanging on, I think, by a thread, the IRGC. And, so they've kind of, burnt many of their allies. I mean, attacked, United Arab Emirates and Dubai and Saudi Arabia and some of the allies. But I think one of the things that Trump has been skilled at, and it's worked as far as the Abraham Accords, I think it's working in Venezuela, is he really, begins the interaction of economic interests and bringing people together with shared economic interests. And I think that's what really brought the Abraham Accords together, even the Gaza situation together. And the door is open for Iran in that regard. Of course, it's open now in Venezuela. I think that door may be, as part of you pointed out, negotiations, possibly in the future with Cuba. So that is one avenue of diplomacy. I think that Trump is very effective at. And I think that will create some bridges and some common interests that way. And that could bring some of the changes as far as leadership in some of those countries eventually down the road, too. But I appreciate your comments. I don't see everything the same, but I think you have some very good insights. And I'm just interested a little more about you. I'm sorry I missed your introduction, but you're very well informed and I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
Any response, John?
I would just have to say that one cannot judge the outcome of situations like this immediately.
Right.
I hesitate to make very decisive conclusions unless I can have a corollary to it. This might not happen if a new regime comes to power. There might be more terror and more retribution against the people, depending on who actually is in charge now. All of that, there's so many other circumstances that come up. Put another way, who would have thought the Houthis would be essentially out of the picture in Yemen, or the Assad family would be sent packing in Syria. For that matter, there's a new president in Syria that Israel and the United States appear to be getting along with. He's also a former Al-Qaeda terrorist. I happen to believe that, as the historians Will and Ariel Durant said, that if you have a world with Jesus Christ and Attila the Hun, the advantage goes to Attila the Hun. There's more bad people than good people in the world. And so I'd say the jury is out on him. All of these are little things, little circumstances, bumps in the road. So I hesitate to say decisively what will happen, but we can have some very cordial discussions, and this has certainly been a cordial discussion on what might happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And my, just to add to what you said, there are so many different perspectives on what, who is and who, what power, who has where and when and to what perspective. And we just don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's unnerving. I tend to favor what Mitch Pomerantz is talking about, but I don't have all the answers and nobody does. And so we'll just have to wait and see. Any other hands raised?
Not at this time.
Let us know when that changes. Thank you, Trent.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Good. So, Congressman, I'm sorry. God, sorry. John.
I accept the nomination.
That'd be great. So, John, what do you, what other issues are crossing your, path these days?
Well, certainly someone mentioned the state.
1-3-5-1-0-3-4-5-5.
Go ahead, John. Sorry.
I would also, I would say the SAFE Act and the fate of it, are increasingly becoming important in the halls of Congress. The SAFE Act, of course, would require proof of citizenship, not unlike the national ID that's required in Colombia before people vote. I don't know why that is not, a bipartisan measure accepted by both parties. 80% of the people in the United States believe only citizens should vote, citizens who can prove themselves. That's certainly on my mind. I've been watching the primaries around the country. South Carolina has a very interesting race coming up for governor on Tuesday, or for the Republican nomination for governor. And I'm looking carefully at Latin America. I mentioned I was in Colombia. On Sunday, they're going to have a runoff election and will almost certainly elect the law and order candidate, a right of center candidate, Abelardo de la Estrella. And this would make Colombia the 8th country to have gone from left to right in the past 2 years. That's a very significant change that I would not have believed possible a generation ago. So those are some of the things I'm looking at right now.
We do have another hand.
Let's take it.
All right. Who is it?
Kevin.
Kevin again? Or another Kevin? Okay.
Well, thank you. And I concur completely. And, you know, one of the things, components to all of this, and geopolitically speaking, that hasn't really been addressed, is the role of China in some of this. And, you know, they are a threat. They've really been aggressive in South American region. And, of course, they're very connected to Iran, too. So part of the moves that this administration has taken as far as regarding, I think, even Iran, and as a component of this, but Venezuela, Cuba, and elements of South America is in consideration of that influence. And one of the more disturbing developments of their influence is in Brazil.
in Bolsonaro and what they've done there. Of course, you've got the, trying to devalue the dollar and take it away as a reserve currency worldwide too. And there's a concerted effort there. So I think some of these things that we're seeing as far as actions against the cartels, against some of the regimes that have been partnering with Russia and China, but primarily China is the bigger threat right now, I think, geopolitically. And this, I think, is part of addressing that, as well, some of these actions we're seeing here. And thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. John, I want to talk about the Republican primaries, because it seems the thing that sort of surprised me, I guess it shouldn't, is what's going on in, for the Senate primaries, certainly in Texas and the government in Texas, that the Trump supported candidate won. Not only did he win, they won convincingly. And I'll be honest, I'm not a Trump supporter. I find him to be not a honorable guy, not a good president. Having said that, I am surprised that, the Republicans have closed ranks against a guy who's not that popular in the polls. I mean, even the most optimistic polls put his approval rate like 45% or 40, something like that. How do you view that? What is your sense about all that?
Pardon me now. Whose approval rating is 42 to 45%? You were talking about Trump.
I mean, I've heard Trump's support rate running anywhere from like 38, 37% to around 45%, depending on the poll.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say this. He still packs a pretty powerful punch, no matter what the polls say. And the Trump endorsement is still worth a lot. Except when he gets bad advice, such as South Carolina. As a favor to the outgoing governor, Henry McMaster, he endorsed his lieutenant governor, Pam Everett. She is about to lose very badly to the four-term Attorney General, Alan Wilson. Wilson was originally a Ted Cruz for President booster, but came around to Donald Trump and supported him in 24 fully, as did his father, Congressman Joe Wilson. That was a mistake to get involved there, and Trump will get his comeuppance from the Palmetto State next week. I'd have to say that candidates in states have their own following, their own charisma. There was a gentleman in Georgia, a billionaire healthcare magnate, Rick Johnson. And he won the Republican primary for governor over the Trump-endorsed candidate, Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones. How did he campaign? He would govern the state like Trump. And he said he would be the governor Trump likes most. And he did this with a very intense television advertising campaign. So while those candidates he particularly blesses don't always win, the candidates who are nominated to a fault profess their support for the current occupant of the White House. And it's the old, rental car ad. They must be doing something right because they're winning.
I have to say I am particularly surprised in Texas. Paxton has all kinds of baggage. And Cornyn has its problems, I'm sure. But the fact that, it was a close race until President Trump endorsed Paxton and then he won in a landslide, I find, not surprising that he won, but he won by as much as he won.
We have about 5 minutes to go, by the way. So,
and I was going to say, when you talk about, baggage that he carries, you mean the same baggage that Graham Platner, the Democratic nominee for the Senate in Maine, carries, don't you?
That's a fair comparison. And I'm not a fan of his either. But
But I think the Paxton thing actually is more, it's not just his, well, the Plattner thing is primarily his Nazi connections, you know, and his stuff they did with women. And there's some of that with the Texas situation, but he also was accused of all kinds of, you know, embezzling and all kinds of other stuff. You know, I mean, there's a reason why he was impeached in Texas.
And acquitted.
Fair enough. Right. Anyway, I'm just sort of surprised by that.
And the Nazi tattoo, the abuse of women notwithstanding, Graham Plattner also posted some things, unkind comments about his fellow veterans and about white rural Americans that he put up on Reddit.
Yep.
And that are out there for people to see. Now, I listened to Bernie Sanders defend him one afternoon, and he said, here's someone who had 4 tours of duty as a combat veteran in the Marine Corps and in the Army. And he said, then he was treated for post-traumatic stress in a VA hospital, married a nice young lady. So all of this is in the past. Okay, I'll give him that much. But at the same time, I'd say, why is it that he got rid of the Nazi tattoo on his chest when he was 40 years old and looking at a political career?
Well, I think that's a fair question. I think that's a fair question. You know, I've heard, and I don't want to get too down this road, that this whole Nazi tattoo is a thing for some people in the military as sort of a machismo thing. You know, it's not a, you know, they don't support Hitler. It's just sort of this, you know, we're really cool for doing this in certain elements of the military.
Right.
Having said that, you know, it bothers me that somebody like Plattner is going to be running against, Susan Collins in Maine. And I would not be shocked if she wins. Which is really, you know, from my perspective, a shame, but that's the way it goes. I wish we had more time to talk about the Save America Act, because there's all kinds of complexities with that. And it especially impacts the disability community, because for many of us, it is harder, not impossible, but harder for us to get the documentation that this law is going to require folks to get if it passes. And there's a lot of concern in the disability community about all this, which I think is worth talking about. Unfortunately, we don't have much time to do that, but I just hope that you sort of consider that as you sort of ponder that issue.
I certainly will. And I would respectfully request that you bring on Todd Rokita, Attorney General of, Indiana, who defended their voter ID law right up to the Supreme Court and had to deal with the same problems you talk about. And I won't put words in his mouth. Let him tell you how they dealt with it.
Send me his information, John, and I'll see what I can do.
Okay. You got a deal, Bob.
And by the way, if you could give him a heads up that we'll be contacting him and
I'll do that right
recommend
now.
Our show, that would be wonderful. I'd certainly be happy to have him on the show.
And by way of disclosure, Todd was my intern when I was the political correspondent for Human Events. And he did a good job for me, and I used to call him Todd Almighty.
That's Todd very catchy.
Almighty.
Very catchy.
Yeah.
John, I want to thank you, and I know Peter does as well, taking the time once again to be with us here on In Perspective. And we would like to have you back at 3 months, as Mitch suggested. We'll talk about it privately. But thanks again.
I never turn you down unless something comes up unexpectedly. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. And let me add one thing. When I'm with you all, I always feel good because our conversations are civil and respectful of one another. But I also feel almost inadequate around you because you have overcome so much and do so much for so many.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor and a pleasure and to be with you today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you as well.
We're delighted to have you, John.
And greetings to children. Go safe with God.
We'll figure this out by getting you on.
Everybody, go safe with God's abundant blessings, and we'll talk next week. Have a great week.